Hi, friends, and welcome to the Plus Mommy Podcast. I'm your host, Jen McClellan, and here we explore plus-size pregnancy, motherhood, and body love. From bumps to bellies, we talk about it all. Now, let's get started. Hi, friends. Today, we are joined by Reagan Chastain. Reagan is internationally recognized thought leader in the fields of health at every size, weight stigma. She's an author, certified health coach, functional training specialist, and someone I deeply admire and have wanted to have on the show for so long. And I can't believe she's here and I'm so excited. Hi, Reagan.
Hello. I am equally excited to be here. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. You came into my life at the beginning of my journey of starting Plus Size Birth, because I started like Plus Size Mommy Memoirs and all of that in 2011. And you had Dances with Fat. You started in 2009.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. So that was available, but you were just really bridging into more of your health at every size work. So I was trying to tip my toe into like weight bias and fat activism. Your name kept coming up. And I was just so like blown away by things that you were saying, but they like made me uncomfortable, which I think is really good and really necessary, because that's part of the journey of unpacking our own weight bias, right? And I'll never forget you even had me, oh gosh, like 10 years ago, come on one of your talks. And I was still learning and still unpacking. And I made a comment about like, studies show that a little bit of weight loss can improve fertility outcomes. And you like, you gently interrupted me in the nicest way and corrected me and taught me. And I've never forgotten that, because I needed that, right? Like, I feel like all of us who are on this journey, we still are going to learn and unpack. But you, I share all that to say you've taught me so much. And I deeply appreciate how you have helped me to not only be a better educator and advocate and fat activism, but to continue to unpack my own weight bias. And so I wanted to have you on the show just because you're amazing and I've like want to amplify you all the time. But also, I thought it'd be interesting to spend some time kind of asking questions that I think a lot of us have, like, well, what's wrong with weight loss? You know, like having some of these conversations where you and I have a much different perspective and depth and your background in research and weight and science, like, but to ask the questions that I think we a lot of people still wonder and question. So all of that to say, you're amazing. Thank you for being here. And I'm so excited for this conversation.
I am so, so touched. And I do remember that at the talk. And it's, I want people to know that when I talk about these are mistakes that we make, or these are things that we think that are wrong, I made those mistakes. I thought those wrong things. So I'm also always still learning. And there's so many people who came before both of us whose shoulders were
right.
all standing
oh,
on.
Yes. Yes.
You know, a lot of them with a lot less privilege than I have. And
well, why don't you tell the listeners a little about yourself before we dive into this conversation? I gave a brief intro, but tell us more about like your passion and your work.
Yeah. So I got into this originally in 2009. I was blogging. I was a competitive ballroom dancer at the time. And I had been on my own little personal journey like years before that, about at this point, 20 years ago now. I had done a literature review to try to find the best diet. My background is in research methods and statistics. I am a massive nerd. And so that seemed like I had been yo-yo dieting for years. And I was like, I've never really done the research. Let's find the best diet. And what I found was that there wasn't a single study where more than like a tiny fraction of people were having anything approximating significant long-term weight loss. And so, but I was on my own journey. I had a corporate job. I was a consultant. So I was really not like telling people about this. I was just thinking of it as my own thing. And then in ballroom dancing, this judge caught me after a competition and kind of trapped me against an elevator to tell me repeatedly she couldn't stand to look at me because my dress showed my arms.
Oh my goodness.
And I was sick and I was exhausted because I had just danced. And so I just kept saying, okay. She was like, I couldn't stand to look at you. And I was like, okay. Right. But in that moment, my back, I had a lot of work like in social justice. I staged my first protest in kindergarten.
Wow.
And like all through school, I would like, thank God my mom is like the, I could not have had a better mom. Like she was behind me 100%, right? All the time with this ridiculousness. Anything I thought was unfair, I was going to tell the most powerful person I could find about it as soon as I possibly could. like a little second grade me. And so, and I had in college gotten into doing a lot of queer and trans activism work.
Yes.
I came out as queer in college in Texas in the mid 90s.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember lobbying for queer and trans rights in the Texas legislature in like 1996. It was a special time.
Wow.
Yeah. But so I had this background and I had done anti-racism solidarity work, but I had not thought of fat people as a group of people who were being oppressed.
Right.
I really thought of the way I was treated as a fat person as like a personal thing. That's why I decided I wasn't going to pursue weight loss anymore, but I didn't think of that. Like, and I at the time I was on like LiveJournal. I don't know if anybody out there.
Yeah.
I got on LiveJournal back when you had to know somebody who had a code. They only had a certain number of codes to give out. So you had to be special enough. So like, shout out to my best friend, Kelrick, for getting me on LiveJournal. But I was like writing about it to my friends there, but not. And so I had this thing with this judge, and I realized in that moment, like, oh, this isn't a me thing. This is a group of people being oppressed.
Wow.
And so I started Dances with Fat a couple days later just to talk about my experiences as a fat ballroom dancer, and then started to think about more from like a civil rights issue, and then like, oh no, well, this research I did is really like tying into this. And at the time that I started it, I am so embarrassed to say I did not know there was a fat liberation community or a Hays community. So I was like literally just, this is what I think. And then later on, I said something about like the only two things you can tell by somebody's body size is what size they are and your own prejudices and stereotypes about that. And somebody was like, yeah, like Marilyn Juan already said that. And I was like, what now? And so I immediately reached out to her. I was like, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. And she was lovely and we're friends now, but like, she was absolutely lovely and says the same thing I say now, which is like, I just want to get this out. Right. Like, I'm not looking to be famous for being the person who said this one thing. But anyway, so that started Dances with Fat. And I did that for years, and for a period of years, blogged every single day.
Yeah, I was showing you that I have your book.
Oh my God,
you came out in 2012 that it's signed by you, that I've had on my bookshelf. Fat, the owner's manual to navigate a thin, obsessed world with your health, happiness, and sense of humor intact. Like, these were, you know, yes, of course, there have been books like this out there and incredible thought leaders doing this work. But, you know, when you did this and launched this over a decade ago, there weren't as many, and there weren't as many voices, and there weren't as many blogs. And I just remember some of the things that you were starting to write about. I love that you said that you're a nerd because you're so into like the science and studies, but that also LiveJournal and activism, to me, that all came together in my head of why it's so relatable to read your Substack and your newsletter, Dances with Fat, I don't know if you still send out the newsletter, but I would get it for years and years and years and years and years, right? But it was easily digestible, where I feel like a lot of the sciencey, awesome nerd people, I'm like, well, you're so smart and cool, but I don't understand what you're saying. But the way you write, it is so easy to learn, to understand, and to feel empowered by and sometimes challenged by. So just all that to add, like the way your background brings into the activism work that you do, it's so easily digestible, and you're such a talented writer.
Oh, thank you so, so much. I feel like, I don't know if it's like privilege or luck of the draw personality, but that the ability to like take complicated stuff and make it simple. Like, as a consultant, it's what I did, you know, as I do a lot of it in blogging and try, because I bristle against the idea of academic language. I think every study should have to have a plain language counterpart.
Thank you. Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I do not care how many big words you know. I care what the results of your study were in plain language that everybody can understand. And so I think that like that elitism that is born of white supremacy then keeps people from having an understanding. And often in weight science research, as you well know, that's not accidental.
Right.
Right. They're not accidentally being disingenuous and misleading in the wording they choose and the conclusions they write. So thank you very, very much for that. I enjoy it very, I really, what I do is I say a dream job that I wish didn't exist.
Absolutely. I say the same thing about my plus size birth work too. Like, absolutely. So since 2012, about, you've been doing this work full time, and you have workshops, and you're a consultant, and you've spoken to like Google and like all these huge, 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 incredible businesses that like have brought you in. And I'm curious, because you've been doing this so long, What is the response that you were getting when you first started speaking compared to now? Has that shifted? I really hope it has.
It has. So college and corporate audiences there's been progression, but they were always kind of the cool places to talk. Yeah. And Google, that talk was one of my favorites ever because Google and Caltech, because they were like, what? Like when you talk about the data, they were so into it and they were like, talk faster and tell us more. And that's like everything I want to hear from, you know, an audience. So like that, those were really cool talks. But the place I really see the difference is in healthcare providers.
Yeah.
And I talked and they made up less of my audience when I started speaking in 2009 and then went full time in 2012. And now they make up my primary audience. But like in 2009, the Q&As were straight up hostile.
I bet.
People yelling, people walking out, people calling me a liar, absolutely hostile. And often it was like one person with authority created this talk and they made everybody else come. So we would do everything to try to like take the edge off. You can wear jeans. We brought food, like anything to try to make these like less hostile. And now like there's still a ton of weight stigma in healthcare, a ton of it. Absolutely. It's still part of the training, but I'm really seeing a shift, right? More people come to the talk having heard of these things. More people are willing to engage in these things. I get a lot more emails afterwards. Hey, you know, can you talk about this? Can you help me with this? I had one person like months after the talk, because I always start by saying, you know, people who are doctors sometimes have a hard time learning from people who aren't doctors.
Yeah.
And so he said, you know, I don't know if you said that to me, but I know now you were talking about me.
Oh,
and he
wow.
said, I was so mad through your whole talk. And, you know, but I keep seeing what you were saying in my patients. And so can you come on board and consult with my practice? And now he's in, this is months ago, has moved his practice to a almost completely weight neutral basis.
You are changing so many lives. Like that one exchange is going to impact hundreds of people. Yeah. Like that's amazing. Thank you.
And that's the thing about activism. Like those kind of wins don't come along very often.
Right. But when they do.
Yeah. And often you have no idea, right? People say, thanks, this was great. And you don't know if they're actually going to go and implement that. Yeah. And so all we can do for those of who are out there and wanting to do kind of activism work, all we can do is do the work. We can't control the outcome. And to me, that's the most important thing that keeps me doing it is like, my job is to do the work to the absolute best of my ability. And then I can't control what people do with that. I can just do more work.
Do more work. Yeah, no, I agree. And it can be real scary to be a fat person standing in front, because I've done it too, standing in front of a room full of healthcare professionals and be like, hey, stop treating us like crap. But like, we're not just saying that. Here's all this evidence to show that you are. And here's all this evidence to show that what you're doing is not evidence-based. And like, it's like you have the evidence on your side. And yet, because you exist in a larger body than often people with weight bias just aren't hearing what you're saying.
I will say when I very first started, I would talk about like patient engagement and, you know, people who feel shamed don't come back to healthcare. The general attitude was like, look, if they don't come to the doctor, that's on them. And I was like, okay, you know what? New plan. You're obligated to provide ethical, evidence-based medicine. What you're doing isn't it. Here's an hour and a half of research. Why? Fight me. And the Q&As got so much more productive because I was like, you better be packing some evidence. You raise your hand as high as you want. But if you're just going to say everybody knows or some organization says like we're not equals in this conversation.
Yeah. Oh, and
and now, but now like I talk about patient engagement all the time. And there's John Robison, who's one of the founders of the Health at Every Size movement, told me the story about, so we all know like Galileo, the story, you know, created the telescope, figured out the earth revolved around the sun. They called him a heretic, put out a crash test. Terrible. What John told me was that Galileo's contemporaries refused to look through the telescope.
Whoa.
And so they weren't like, this is poorly made or your math is off. They just wouldn't look. And I often tell that story at the beginning of talks when I feel like the audience might be less likely to look through the telescope with me.
Wow.
Because I think that is what people do. They just believe what they believe so strongly.
Yeah.
And they are simply unwilling to grapple with the evidence. So they're not saying, I think you're wrong about this evidence because I've investigated it too. They're just like, no way. And then that's good enough for them.
Wow. Well, let's look at the telescope. Let's look through the telescope together, right? Like, let's do it together. So I think, you know, there's a range of listeners. Hi, listeners. And some people are like, yeah, fat activism, Reagan Chastain. I subscribe to their Substack. I love all their stuff. And other people are like, oh, my first introduction to Reagan and my first introduction to, they said this Haze thing earlier. So what is Haze? What is that? What is Haze?
Sure. So Health at Every Size, the actual words Health at Every Size are the branded trademark of the Association for Size, Diversity, and Health. And Haze is a part of a larger movement of weight neutral health. Basically, the idea that when we're talking about individuals, weight neutral health essentially says that when we're talking about individual behaviors, that health supporting behaviors have more benefits with fewer risks than weight loss attempts.
Got it.
But it goes beyond that to say that health has to be about creating a world where people are affirmed and have access. And so it's about bringing down barriers and increasing access to health and healthcare based on what people want. It's about ending oppression, right? Racism is a public health crisis in our country that is often treated like something that, you know, people of color just should deal with on an individual basis. So it's all of those things, social determinants of health. It's about saying that public health is about increasing access and decreasing barriers, not about making fat people's health the public's business, which is what's happening now. So it's a broad-based movement. It's been around for a really, really long time. And it's an evidence-based movement.
Yeah. Thank you. But Reagan, and I'm just speaking as what things that would come to mind when people are just entering in, working through weight bias and working through the society that has led us to believe that fat is wrong and bad. But Reagan, every time I go to the doctor, that's the focus. And my doctor tells me I need to lose weight. So isn't my doctor right?
So I'm going to say no. And here's what happened. So there's a lot of moving pieces to this, but we have a lot of research, much of it funded by the weight loss industry, that simply shows that higher weight people have higher rates of a certain health issue. And so then the assumption is made, oh, well, if higher weight people have this health issue more often, then obviously their weight must be to blame. And obviously the solution is for them to lose weight. And then this entire paradigm stems from that error. That is not scientific thinking. And literally the first thing you learn on your first day in research methods class is that correlation does not imply causation. So just because two things happen at the same time, you cannot ever assume that one causes the other. And this gets tricky in healthcare research because we use correlation in healthcare research all the time. Yeah, often a causal mechanism isn't identifiable. However, it is not responsible to do that until you explore what are called confounding variables. So you have to ask as a researcher, you find this relationship, okay, higher weight people have a higher rate of this, you know, health issue. What else could be contributing or causing this? So what else do higher weight people experience more that would cause a higher rate of this? And it can be something as simple as more often higher weight people's blood pressure is taken with a cuff that is too small, giving it too high reading. It can also be higher weight people are more likely to experience weight stigma and weight cycling or yo-yo dieting, which is by far the most common outcome of a weight loss attempt. And both of those are also correlated with the health issues that get correlated to weight.
Yeah.
And so the studies that look at these correlations do so uncritically. They almost never mention, let alone control for, things like testing bias, weight stigma, weight cycling, healthcare inequalities. And then they're used to boost up weight loss as the correct method. And a good comparator would be, I think, cis male pattern baldness is incredibly highly correlated with cardiac incidents. If we stop there, we would say, well, my gosh, these people have to grow hair. Obviously. Like, it's the obvious difference. And we might have a war on baldness and we calculate bald people's, you know, cost on society for their heart attacks and say they should risk their lives and quality of life to grow hair, progressively more expensive and dangerous interventions. When in fact, it's another issue that's causing both the cis male pattern baldness and the cardiac incidents, right? Yeah. Which we know because they used science and they went further than just saying, obviously these people should grow hair. But when it comes to weight and health, it stops there. And so the research, I mean, I was well aware of issues with bias in research, lack of trans and non-binary representation, underrepresentation of people of color. In college, we called it the 150-pound white guy problem. the most research was done on kind of quote unquote average weight cis white men, and everyone else was just supposed to be extrapolatable, which is ridiculous.
That's our whole healthcare and maternity system too. It's like all designed by white men. They're like, here, lay on your back and spread your legs open, which it doesn't even make sense to bring a human into the world with. Yeah, it's so frustrating. And we know that Black bodies, horrific things were happened and studied, especially around maternity care as well. Horrific things happened.
Yeah. And weight stigma, the idea of pathologizing higher weight bodies in general, the body mass index that we use to pathologize higher weight bodies, all of these things are rooted in and inextricable from racism and anti-Blackness. And they all continue to disproportionately impact those communities to this day. But yeah, so your doctor thinks that you should lose weight because they've had a really faulty education based on really poor research. A lot of it funded. I do a whole talk about weight stigma and capitalism that I will not do right now. But the enmeshment of the weight loss industry in the healthcare industry cannot be overstated. They're on committees that are controlling decisions. They're using AstroTurf organizations to influence both from the provider level to the government level. Yeah. So we've got this idea, right, that, oh, well, weight loss is obviously going to make your outcomes the same as a thin person. And that's not proven, and that's not scientific thinking, but that's what your doctor was taught.
Yeah. And then I'll never forget getting a little mad at you. I never told you this, but not really mad. But I remember when you were really focused on the study showing that weight loss fail, diets fail 95% of the time. And this was when I was just beginning to unpack all my things. And we're so led to believe that diets is what we have to do. And it's everything we have to focus on. And then you were like, okay, so here's the evidence that shows that dieting doesn't work. And I was just like, but wait, like it's hard to unpack that when you, especially those of us that grew up in the 80s and 90s, when that was, everyone was on a diet and a different diet every week. And we weren't having the same conversations that parents are having now with their kids and intuitive eating. What's that, you know? So that was tough. That was tough to digest. But then I looked back and I sat and I was like, but that's like the story of my weight story, right? Is every diet I did that made me heavier and hate myself more in the long run. And here was you pointing out the evidence of my body. And it was hard to take. And so what is your advice to people that are starting to unpack things and know that, okay, well, if weight loss doesn't, if dieting doesn't work and weight loss shouldn't be the focus and I can be healthy at every size. And here are these wonderful finding joy in movement, right? Which is something that you're so good at. But like, how do I get past the fact that I am so entrenched in the belief that I must be smaller. I must change.
Yeah. So there are a lot of moving parts there. So the research, I still love you for being mad at me. It happens all the time, right? But
I'm not mad anymore. So this is so long ago. It was really hard. Yeah. And now everyone talks about it, right? Everyone talks about these studies. But when it was first starting to be really talked about, and you were talking about it a lot, it was like, wait a minute. Like, it just, you know, it's often our parents that put us on these diets, right? Yeah. And parents know best. And, you know, it's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's research like Stunkard et al. Was in 1959. And they not only found a greater than 95% failure rate in their 100-person sample, but they looked at research for the past 30 years.
Wow.
So that's research starting in the 1920s. And like the NIH made a statement in 1992 saying that almost everyone who loses weight gains it back. And Miller in 1999 and Manitomiyama in 2007 and the Australian Medical and Mental Health and Research Council, I may have gotten that name a bit wrong, the Australian Council in 2013. And then, you know, all the way to Gazer and Angotti in 2021 and beyond. So we've got 100 years of research that shows that the most likely outcome by far, the vast majority of people who attempt intentional weight loss will lose weight short term and gain weight long term. And what happened is, going back to the weight loss industry, they knew that from the beginning.
Multi-billion dollar weight loss industry.
Yeah, what are they at? Like 72 billion a year?
And they knew that from the beginning.
Yeah. So Weight Watchers' own charter says that they are a repeat business model. And so what they figured out is that there's a two-part biological response to intentional weight loss, to that restriction, right? At first, your body loses a little bit of weight while it tries to figure out what is going on. And then your body has all of these systems to keep you from famine, right? So you're not eating as much food as your body needs to survive because you're hoping it will eat itself and become smaller. And your body hears, like, I'm sending these hunger signals and you're not sending food. So the only thing I can imagine is happening is there's no food. So no problem. I've got you covered. Let me slow down our metabolism. Let me increase the hormones that tell you you're hungry. Let me decrease the hormones that tell you that you're full. Let me lose type 2 muscle because it's too expensive to keep, like all of these things. And so the body physiologically changes itself to become a weight regaining, weight maintaining machine. And so year one, most people, not everyone, some people gain weight from the get, but most people will lose a little bit of weight in year one. But then years 2 through 5, almost everyone will regain their weight. And what the diet industry has done brilliantly is take credit for the first part of the biological response and then blame us and get us to blame ourselves and get other people to blame us for the second part of the biological response, where we regain the weight so that we go back to them and we try again. Right. And it's important to understand that weight cycling is not benign. So sometimes people will say, well, it's like quitting smoking. It's really hard, but you got to keep trying. Well, a smoker is, first of all, smoking is a single behavior that every smoker participates in. Body size is simply a shared size. People have vastly different behaviors, symptomologies, et cetera. But beyond that, a smoker is healthier for every cigarette they don't smoke. So if they quit for 2 weeks and go back, they are healthier for having not smoked for that 2 weeks. Weight cycling is not the same. Weight cycling is independently linked with increased inflammation, increased mortality, most of the health issues that are blamed on body size. And so this is not like this try again, try again, try again thing is not benign. It's harmful. And I hear doctors sometimes will say, oh, well, yeah, weight loss fails 95% of the time, but you just have to keep trying until you're in the 5%. And I'm like, all right, look, not everybody took statistics. And I'm aware that they teach statistics in medical school, but they teach a lot of things in medical school. So maybe like this wasn't the class you put your all into, but I did. So let me tell you for sure, that's not how statistics work. That is the logic people use to play the lottery, right? Like this is not okay that we're doing this as a healthcare intervention. But beyond that is the fact that weight stigma is real.
Yeah.
And it impacts higher weight people in every aspect of their lives. Wanting to be thin is not just about being healthy or believing that you'll be healthier, but about moving yourself out of a stigmatized class.
Yeah. I had Jessica Wilson on the show and she said that, you know, it's the pursuit of anti-blackness too.
Yes. 100% rooted in
racism
in anti-blackness, in white supremacy.
Yeah.
Jessica's book is incredible.
Yes.
It's Always Been Ours. Also Sabrina Strings, Fearing the Black Body, yes. Deshaun Harrison's Belly of the Beast. Excellent work about like exactly that. But yeah, so for me as I said, I'm queer, came out in the 90s at a time when in my own personal experience, it was very common to have somebody suggest that if you didn't like homophobia, you should become straight, right? Go to ex-gay therapy. And, you know, and so I, while no two oppressed communities are the same, as someone who's both queer and fat, I can definitely see the parallels there.
Yeah.
And that, like, as a fat person, I'm told being fat is a choice. It's a bad choice. It's bad for society. And you should choose to be thin. And thinness is a way to escape weight stigma. And that is also a message the diet industry is currently co-opting, yeah. Right? That the solution to weight stigma is to become thin. And I just want to be crystal clear, no matter what somebody thinks about weight and health in their relationship, the idea that stigmatized people should have to change themselves to suit their oppressors to escape stigma is always wrong.
Wrong.
Always.
Yeah.
So there's that piece too. So like, for me, what I'll say is, as I was on this journey, I realized like, weight stigma is real. Mm-hmm. It's going to harm me because you can't love yourself out of systemic oppression. You cannot love yourself so much that an MRI that doesn't accommodate you suddenly does.
Yeah.
You can't love yourself into a roller coaster that wasn't made to accommodate fat people. So it's going to affect me, but I spent years fighting my own body on behalf of weight stigma and that got me nowhere.
Same.
So now I fight weight stigma on behalf of my body. And that has been a much better choice.
Of so many people that need it. Are you plus size and pregnant or trying to conceive? Do you wonder where you can find cute plus size maternity clothes? Or when you'll start showing and how to embrace your pregnant body? What about having a healthy pregnancy and how to reduce your increased risk?
Find the answers to these questions and so much more within the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook. From nutrition and physical activity to prenatal care expectations and the importance of hiring a size-friendly care provider, you'll not only learn information to help you make informed decisions throughout your pregnancy, but start to develop a new relationship with your body. Download this guide and start using it at any point in your pregnancy. Stop Googling and start feeling empowered today. Use code PLUSMOMMY to get 20% off the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook.
Okay, so I now know what Health at Every Size is. I know that my doctor needs a little updating on things. I'm starting to get it. Okay, dieting doesn't work, but Reagan, my mobility. Let's say my mobility is really being impacted, or I assume it's being impacted by my weight, and maybe I can't get on the floor and play with my child, or I can't do these things, and I'm really. I'm really worried. So what is your wisdom here? What should I do?
Yeah. So, you know, mobility and ability are real things. Ableism is also a real thing that always comes into play here. We talk about from Kimberly Crenshaw's framework for intersectionality, the idea that people who have multiple marginalized identities are marginalized in the individual identities and at the intersections of them. So for people who are dealing with mobility issues with disability and who are fat, there are different issues. There are different issues in how they'll be treated. A fat person on a scooter versus a thin person on a scooter, for example, may be treated very differently. And that will be compounded if they have additional marginalized identities. And then structurally, a fat person who needs a higher weight rating for a mobility device will have a harder time finding one. It will be more expensive typically. So there are all these pieces to it. So I never want to gloss over that. And it can really complicate these, you know, when we talk about creating healthy, happy, peaceful relationships with our bodies, that can really be, you know, troubled by things like chronic pain, chronic illness, disability, mobility challenges. And that is fair and that's real. And, you know, those are all real things. In terms of, you're like, I want to increase my mobility. Just having to look at the evidence. And I got my first fitness certification in 1996. I hold a bunch of them now. And so when I look at this, I just look at what does the research say will work? And one thing I think about is it might be best to start with the mobility device, right? Because for me, it's like, what does this person want to do? I want to be able to get out and, you know, see the world. Okay, so if we get a scooter now, because what happens is mobility devices are used as like last resort, right? Like, oh, this is when you've just given up, which is ridiculous, right? Use it. Don't use it, but the all the ableism around it, and often it's internalized ableism or the fear of the very real fear of the ableism someone will encounter, right? But so looking at how can I solve this now, right? So can I just get a higher, like, you know, bed or something that I can play with my kids on? You know, what is the option to like make this easier right now? And then trying to lose weight to improve mobility, like it doesn't matter. And this is what's tricky. People will say, oh no, I know what you're saying, but I need to lose weight for health reasons, or I need to lose weight for mobility. And I get where they're coming from, but it doesn't make it any more likely. Mm. So 95% chance you're going to lose some weight short-term and gain it back long-term, up to 66% chance you're going to gain back more than you lost. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being fat or becoming fatter. I do think there's something deeply wrong with something that's considered a healthcare intervention prescribed to 70% of the population that has the opposite of the intended effect the majority of the time. But also just from the perspective, if you feel like your body size is the problem, then attempting weight loss is statistically the worst thing you could do. Mm. It has the most likely outcome is that you will actually end up larger than you started. Right? Now, the good news is that at whatever size you are, you can work on things like strength, like flexibility, like stamina. And there are whatever, you know, ability issues people are working with, there are always thin people with those same situations.
Yes.
And so there are ways to help that don't involve weight loss. And even if your mobility issue is because of your weight, that still doesn't make weight loss any more likely.
Mm. And I'm sure some people are listening and they're hating you like I did a decade ago. Not hating you, but it is hard to take. But here's the thing. we got to get uncomfortable. We got to hear things that are hard to get past, right? Because if we keep doing the same thing we've been doing, speaking from personal experience, it just made me have more and more struggles because I just kept losing and gaining and gaining and gaining. And then it can impact things that I know that can help. Water aerobics, right? Like just moving my body in ways that bring me joy and release all these amazing endorphins that have helped me with swelling and some mobility. Chair yoga can be fantastic. Like, and then there's people that you have done like marathons and with triathlons. Like, so again, we all know health at every size, like you can be healthy at every size, but for people that are struggling, weight loss shouldn't be the focus, but what could help with your chronic pain? Sometimes being hydrotherapy can be amazing. Or like you said, getting whatever mobility support you need without having shame around that, doing what we need to live the best lives that we can live without always feeling like the solution has to be shrinking.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, because I do enjoy doing fitnessy things. And so I want to be clear, like there's this idea of the good fatty, bad fatty dichotomy,
right?
The fat people who perform health to someone's satisfaction are better than those who don't. And the first thing I want to point out, because it sounds like I'm okay with those fat people who eat right and exercise, but the fat people who don't exercise and eat like this, I'm not okay with. And it's important to understand you could divide literally any group of people into those two categories.
Totally. Yes. Right? Yes.
Two kinds of blonde people, two kinds of Rotarians. So this is just a way to justify fat phobia. And I can tell you for sure, yeah, I've done both. Having a Netflix marathon and completing a marathon, morally equivalent activities.
Right? Yes,
it doesn't make anybody better or worse.
It does not. Yeah. I love that. I love that analogy. Yeah. But both can bring us joy, right?
Yeah.
And both can be an escape from the stigma and crappiness that we are impacted by our daily lives. And mental health is another thing that's so important. So that Netflix marathon can be really good for our mental health, as can be moving in joyful ways. But I love that part of the health at every size, just looking like what ways finding movement instead of like the word exercise, like movement that brings you joy, I think has for me been a good light switch as opposed to a punishment. And we know that with maternity care too, like it's movement that can really help us when we're looking at our wellness throughout pregnancy too. And it's not saying you gotta run a marathon. It's just little things, the little steps to that. Yeah.
And I'll add to that too. Like there's a lot of really reasonable relationships with movement. So for some people, it's about finding joy in movement and like that's their thing. For some people, like a lot of people who manage chronic conditions, because I talked to a lot of people who had real messy breakups with exercise.
Yeah.
Right. Because of dodgeball or the president's physical fitness test or the fat shaming they experienced. So like not participating in movement is a valid choice. There
Absolutely.
Are so many different health supporting behaviors. It's also a valid choice, like for people who are maybe using movement as a way to help manage blood sugar, right? So you say, all right, what's the least amount of movement I can do of the thing I hate the least to get the benefit I'm looking for? And then they do that.
Yeah.
And it's done. So it's not like, it's not joyful. It's like dishes or laundry. Like I do this to support myself. I don't love it. And that's also an incredibly valid relationship with movement. And so it's really important to me that people be able to come. And I think the health at every size and weight neutral health community often overemphasize the idea of joyful movement to the
Thank
point that people feel like they're doing it
but
wrong.
But I don't feel joy. Right? Yeah, I don't feel joy. So I'm not good. Yeah.
And
totally.
Those of us,
I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, totally. And those of us who like fitness for, you know, movement stuff for whatever reason can assume that other people are going to have our thing. Like I hate distance running. I did it because one, I was recovering from a neck injury and I couldn't do anything I liked to do. And two, because it was outside of my comfort zone, but like that, it wasn't, there was no joy. There was accomplishment. I was happy when I stopped, right? I was happy when I got the medal and the banana and got to be done, but like it was not. And so, but people who run were like, oh no, you'll get to a point where you're really going to love it. And I'm like, well, this is my second marathon. So I think that would have happened. Like, I think I'm done after this. But yeah, it's so complicated and so much diet culture and toxic fitness culture gets wrapped into that.
But I love how you balance it and you approach it from all angles. Okay. So I know dieting doesn't work and all these things. And I know that with mobility, if I need something, I need to get it and not feel ashamed. And maybe if there's ways that could strengthen my core, that might help me, or just strength in general. But Reagan, everyone's talking about these weight loss drugs now. Why couldn't I just do that? Why couldn't I? Everyone's doing it. My doctor said they'd give me a prescription tomorrow.
Yeah. So I take a real firm view of body autonomy. So if people want to diet, they can diet. They want to try diet drugs, they can try diet drugs. People's bodies are their bodies. I just want people to know what the research says about them. If somebody is trying to, you know, when somebody's before and after, as or before and during really, comes across my Facebook, what I'm going to say is, you look great in both pictures. If you end up gaining all the weight back, it's exactly what the research said would happen. It's not your fault. I get blocked a lot. And that's fine. But I also get people who come back 3 years later and say, I remember you said that. And it was helpful, because every compliment they're getting now is going to be an insult 2 years from now.
Yeah. Or as me watching people get compliments, it always feels crappy. Like, basically, you're praising your friend for not looking like me. I hate before and after pictures because they just feel like, yeah, they're crappy.
Okay. And they're really before and during, right? Because the after pictures, during, yeah. People, and nobody like broadcasts that picture. So we miss that piece of it, right? And it's all like such a mental horror. But yeah, so weight loss drugs. So Wegovy got approved on a 68-week study that showed that people lost weight at the beginning, and then it started to level off. And at week 68, it started to tick up. And here comes back that research we were talking about, all this research that correlates being higher weight to health issues, because the way the FDA approves drugs is on a risk-benefit analysis. So all drugs have risks and side effects. So they say, hey, are the risks and side effects worth the treatment effect of this drug? And so what the weight loss industry does is point to this mountain of crappy research and say, see, it's so terrible to be fat that it's worth risking people's lives and quality of life on these diet drugs. And the FDA says, yes, of course. And then the drugs get approved. And so that's really what happened with Wegovy. And it should be understood, the maker of Wegovy, Novo Nordisk, has been incredibly aggressive in their marketing. And they were the company that most aggressively price gouged on insulin here in the States. So they have already been very clear that they will kill people for money. So everything they do should be viewed through that lens, everything. And this is no different. So they took a diabetes drug that had a side effect of weight loss. And these are good drugs for diabetes. They work well for people who can't get the glycemic control they want in other ways. They work well for people who are contraindicated on other drugs. There are good things about these drugs. But what they said was, well, what if we gave fat people a double dose of diabetes drugs? Oh, they lose weight for 68 weeks. And so this drug got approved. It has a boxed warning, which is the FDA's strongest warning for risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. There's risk of multiple organ damage. And the common side effects are things like gastrointestinal distress, vomiting, nausea, diarrhea. And we know from studies, their own studies, that the longer the onset of those symptoms, the more weight that's lost. So we know these drugs decrease hunger signals, and we know that they slow gut motility, but we don't know to what extent the weight loss is because you give people flu-like symptoms and they have the flu-like response of losing weight short term.
That does not sound like a fun quality of life.
Not great. And then they did their own 104-week study, and sure enough, at week 68, the weight started going up, and then people started weight cycling. And at 104 weeks or 2 years, as we might say it, weight was trending up. If people go off the drug, the weight flies back on. Their own study shows that, right? Within a year, people gained back 2/3 of the weight and lost 2/3 of the cardiometabolic benefits. And so Novo's unbelievably profitable solution is that people should take this drug for the rest of their life.
The rest of their lives. Oh, well, from a pharmaceutical standpoint, they must have been like doing cartwheels on the boardroom table. Like, this is amazing for our business, and not thinking about all the people who will be harmed along the way.
And this is part, they have been on a long-term plan for this, the weight loss industry, drugs and surgery interests in general, to have simply existing in a higher weight body be seen as a chronic lifelong health condition.
Yeah.
And another, so they're inventing all of these ways to do it. And it should be known, Novo Nordisk is really pulling every page they can from the Purdue Pharma marketing playbook that they used for OxyContin.
So we're gosh, and we look back on all the harm and the things that we could have done to literally save lives.
Yeah. And so Novo saw how successful that was, and that is exactly what they're using. We're seeing the most ridiculous PSAs. There's a PSA with people who play doctors on television talking about these drugs. There's sponsored content or at least content that came from that PSA in like Grey's Anatomy and these medical dramas. They have AstroTurf organizations, which are organizations that claim to be advocating for higher weight people, but are in fact funded by this industry. The quote Obesity Action Coalition is an excellent example. They claim to represent higher weight people. Their main funder is Novo Nordisk at about $600,000 a year. The American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines that came out that recommended their drugs.
Oh yeah, that was next on my list. Yeah.
We could talk about that. Funded by Novo Nordisk.
Wow.
The diabetes is funded by Novo Nordisk. As soon as you start to dig, Novo Nordisk has its hands in everything. And so these diet drugs are, this is their new cash cow because they're being forced to lower the price of insulin. And they're so aggressive that in the UK, where they actually have rules about pharmaceutical advertising, unlike here where our rules are ridiculously lax, they got kicked out of the Pharmaceutical Trade Organization for their influence peddling and poor practices.
Wow.
They're being disciplined for other actions. Like they're getting caught at this, but they're setting up the same system in different countries. So like here in Canada, the AstroTurf organization is Obesity Canada, which used to be called the Canadian Obesity Network, which made the acronym CON, which made them my favorite of these groups for just being honest with their acronym. But there's like Dubai, Australia, where they're doing it everywhere. So they're setting this up and they've promised their shareholders first that they would double their quote obesity sales by 2025. Now they've doubled that goal. So this is...
Follow the money and ask questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, let's just... go. We don't even need to phrase this as a question. So NPR just had their article that I was interviewed for on the American Academy of Pediatrics News guidelines, giving weight loss drugs to children and even recommended for weight loss surgery. And as a parent and as someone who grew up being put on diets, I found this to be utterly horrifying, especially for kids going through puberty, which I have a 12-year-old now going through puberty, like just like babies, they get chunkier and then they get longer. Like this is what our bodies are designed to do. And same with puberty, they get chunkier, then they get longer. They grow. This is how our bodies grow. And the idea of giving children weight loss drugs or weight loss surgery in general is horrifying, but especially during this time of puberty, it just, with like, Reagan, is this evidence-based recommendation?
As you might expect, no. So this came at an interesting time for me. I was giving grand rounds at Children's Minnesota, which is, I think, the second biggest freestanding pediatric hospital. And it was on a Thursday, and I did my final run through on Sunday, and I was like, all right, I'm good. The timings are good. Everything's good. On Monday, I woke up to like 500 texts and messages and emails because these AAP guidelines came out. And I was like, oh my God, I have to figure this out because like...
Oh, I'm so sorry, Reagan. I just realized, I don't think we said AAP is the American Academy of Pediatrics, just for the listeners.
Yeah.
If anyone wasn't tracking what we were saying, I'm so sorry. Okay, continue.
Yeah. So the American Academy of Pediatrics and like, yeah, so Children's Minnesota is lousy with pediatricians. So they were going to have some questions about this. So I had the opportunity to become an expert between Monday and Thursday.
Oh,
and
my
so
gosh.
I published a series of deep dives into their claims on weight and healthcare. And the first was conflict of interest. In fact, the AAP is funded by Novo Nordisk, GlaxoSmithKline, and Genentech. And at least half the authors had taken money from one of those companies or more than one of those companies. And instead of a conflict of interest disclosure, they just said the AAP conducted an independent review and found no bias. The AAP is not in a position to conduct an independent review because they're funded by the makers of the drugs. Oh my God. Fail freshman research methods, F minus, change your major. So there's that piece of it that was absolutely ridiculous. After I got past that, I dug into the research and it is unbelievable how much the research they cited does not support what they're saying. So their main recommendations are intensive health and behavioral lifestyle treatment at 2 years old and up, drugs at 12, surgeries at 13. And so I dug hard into not just what they said, but what did they cite to back that up? And it unbelievably did not. I mean, to such an extent, when I was an undergrad and I had to write an essay for a class I didn't care about, I may have use the trick of just citing like 10 different articles that sounded like they supported what I was saying without really, you know, in the hopes that maybe the teacher wouldn't read them. But I was trying to pass a class that was not important to my major. I was not trying to direct healthcare. Right. I'm not proud of that.
Millions upon millions upon millions of children.
I'm not proud of that. I don't do it anymore, but I wasn't creating guidelines for all the pediatricians to use. Right. So, but yeah, so they don't, most of the studies they cite are on adults and not children. The surgical recommendations for children are based on like 500 kids that were studied in total of all, like a bunch of the studies that they mentioned, look at the data from the same 81 kids. It's ridiculous. They make the nonsense claim that, in fact, these kind of pediatric weight management programs decrease eating disorder risk.
No, and we saw that as an immediate response. I feel like the loudest people besides fat activists that were just like, what is happening, was nutritionists and dietitians and eating disorder specialists that were enraged by the AAP because they're like, we're literally already facing a huge crisis with eating disorders in children. But now this recommendation is just setting our future generations up for disordered eating.
Yeah. And I'll point out, most of the reputable eating disorder organizations came out right away against these. IADEP and NIDA still have not made that happen. And like, let them That's be pallbearers okay. at my funeral so they can let me down one more time, these two groups. For Pete's sake. But yeah, so the only way that they can make this work, and this is not just this study, there's a whole group of researchers and a lot of these studies being funded by Novo Nordisk and the diet industry who are trying to make this claim. And the way they make this claim is by only looking at short-term interventions and only looking at symptoms of binge eating disorder and emotional eating. So if somebody is able to, quote unquote, comply with the diet for a short period of time, yes, they may reduce their binge eating for that short period of time. Yes, they may reduce their quote unquote, and emotional eating is like a whole other can of worms, right? But we're just going to, that's what they're using. So I'll just say that for today. But they, first of all, ignore the symptoms that they're prescribing to patients, right? Restriction, frequent weighing, and the things that are side effects of the drugs and surgeries that are also eating disorder symptoms and red flags. So they ignore yes. those completely and act like they don't count as eating disorder symptoms. And this is how they're trying to create this narrative. And it is absolutely ridiculous. It is not in any way evidence-based. And all of those researchers should be 100% ashamed of themselves, because these are people who know better than what they're doing. Right? These are not freshman research method students.
Yeah. Well, parents listening, if your pediatrician starts having these conversations, I know some of us have way more privilege than others. And some of us have the ability to be like, bye, I'm running out the door, while others could worry that CPS could be called for not saying anything. So some good advice that I've heard is be like, oh, that's interesting. Thank you. Can you give me some literature to go home and review? And then you can just get a different pediatrician, or maybe you want to review it. But it's hard now to be a parent with these new guidelines and worrying about what might come up. I've always written on my son's forms, please do not discuss BMI or weight. Happy to talk about nutrition and physical activity, because that's really the conversations they want to have. So we're able to have the same conversation without me worrying that my kid's going to be shamed. And Reagan, maybe you have some different advice over what to put or what to say, but those are just some things that briefly come to mind as a parent who is worried.
I think your advice to say, don't talk about weight or BMI in front of my child, is really important. If they want to talk about it, and they can talk about it with you, if they're insisting on talking about it, having them talk about it only with you. Right. And yeah. holding that boundary in front of your kid if it starts to happen. I was just talking with a parent who the doctor said, are you worried about her weight? And the parent said no. And so the doctor looked right at the little girl and was like, you shouldn't eat anything white. You should go for a run every day. And this is like a 12-year-old girl who lives in a major city. Like, that's not, no. So, you know, being that strong advocate, and often for parents, and I'm not a parent, so I'm speaking from what other people have told me, that it can be a little bit easier to be there for your kid than it might be for yourself, and to speak up for yourself. So use yeah. that parent bear instinct that you've got to, yeah. and then inoculate your kid beforehand and then talk to them about it afterwards. Look, this Thank is a you, place, yes. you know, and medicine has messed up a lot in the past in a lot of ways. Yeah. And so they call it the practice of medicine for a reason. And I also would yes. say, when especially talking about surgery and drugs, weight loss surgery in general, like, it takes a healthy functioning digestive system and it surgically creates a lifelong disease state. It's something that if this happened to a child because of a disease that they had or because of an accident, it would be considered a tragedy. but for fat kids, it's considered healthcare. And I think that tells you all you really need to know about whether or not this is a good idea.
Period. End of conversation. Yeah, we'll leave that there. All right. So my last question is, how do we live a big, fat, fabulous life? Because this has been intense. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we've had such good, intense conversations that I wanted us to unpack heavy stuff, right? And but I want to end things. I always like to, you know, a little bubbly Jen. I like to end things on like a hopeful, happy message. And there's so much that you bring into that too. But like, you've been doing this, you know, like over 20 years starting to unpack stuff, and you do all this incredible work, but like, what helps you to just have a big, fat, fabulous life?
Yeah. So for me, activism is self-care. When I see injustice, the way that I self-regulate is to do something, right? It doesn't have to be a big thing. I post somebody else's blog. I talk about it on my, you know, I just do. So for me, activism is a form of self-care. And so I do this as much for me as I do it for anybody else. Yeah. And then just understanding again, the shift that I made to say, look, I've been fighting my body on behalf of weight stigma, and instead I'm going to fight weight stigma on behalf of my body, was a massive shift for me. So like, wow. I'm going to try to do whatever I can to survive and thrive in this world. And again, I have a ton of privilege to do that, and I'm very clear about that, but that's, you know, that was the choice that I made. I'm going to, despite weight stigma, I'm going to try to live a life that I love, and then make every decision from that.
I love that so much. And yeah, for me, like not holding, allowing my weight to hold me back, like buying two seats on that airplane so I can travel and get that extender and not hold myself back is how I do. And if someone wants to look at my grocery cart while I'm in the grocery store, that's on them, not on me. Like, and just not, I just really made a big effort to stop allowing my fear of what other people thought of my body to hold me back from living the life I want to live. And that has been hard, but it has been so incredibly rewarding and fun, and wearing a bathing suit in public and having my photos taken in a bathing suit and sharing them. Like, you don't have to do all that, but just even the first time wearing a bathing suit and like not feeling covered up, like it was just so freeing. And then being in the water and like, this feels good. Like just the simple pleasures in life that I feel so often as a fat person, I was afraid to experience. And now I'm like, screw that. I'm going to experience it all and love my life and love myself.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. In terms of like a tip, I would offer that I use like a little slogan. And I started doing this like years ago. And whenever I saw a negative message about my body or somebody like rolling their eyes at me or fashioning me, I would think, hey, that's bull crap for the purposes of this non-explicit podcast. And so it, over the years, I did it very consciously for a long time, and it has become sort of an exoskeleton.
I love it.
Yeah. And so like my, hey, that's bull crap exoskeleton stuff just bounces off of it. And also having lived in the South for 17 years in Texas, like that bless your heart energy of like, oh, I'm surprised you think it's appropriate to act like that. You know, I'm surprised you think it's appropriate to say that to me. Just having those things, whether you say them out loud or in your head, to be like, this is becoming, weight sickness becoming my problem right now, but it's not my fault. And however I deal with it in this moment is valid.
Well, you are absolutely amazing. I really encourage people to follow you, support you, tap into everything you do. So where can we find you? How can we support you? And how can we continue to learn from you?
Oh, thank you for asking. So Weight and Healthcare is my main publication now. Dances with Fat still exists, and it's where my video library is. So I have a bunch of my video workshops, and all of them have like a pay what you can option, so that it's important to me that money not be a barrier to information for folks. So Dances with Fat is the original blog, and you can see, I think there's 1800 blog posts on there, and my video library. Weight and Healthcare is my current project. It's my Substack, and it's where I talk about the intersections of weight science, weight stigma, and healthcare. And then HAES healthsheets.com is a project I started with Dr. Louise Metz, Tiana Dodson, and Dr. Ashley Laramie. And they are diagnosis-specific weight-neutral care guides for patients, practitioners, and advocates. So you can literally like download high blood pressure and see what are the weight-neutral ways to deal with this. There's also a resource and research page. So if you go to the resource tab, if you're trying to navigate weight stigma, there are a lot of resources to help you do that. And then if you, like me, are a giant nerd and you want to read research, there's a big old list of it there that you can get started on.
Well, thank you, Reagan. And where can people find you on social media? I know a lot of us like Instagram. So where can we go follow you and support you there?
So Instagram is Reagan Chastain. It's RAGENCHASTAIN. And you can always find me there, stirring up trouble.
Yeah. Well, again, I am so thankful for all that you've taught me and helped me to be a better fat advocate and helped me to be a better childbirth educator doing this work for people of size. So I am deeply thankful and indebted to the work that you have done and the sacrifices that you've done to be able to do this work. I know you say it brings you joy and it's what you do, but it's not always easy. And I know you deal with a lot of trolls and a lot of BS too. So I deeply thank you for all that you've done and continue to do and all the other voices that you continue to lift up as well. So I encourage everyone to follow Reagan on all the things. I'm subscribed to her Substack. And what one thing I really enjoy, just another little pitch for you, is like reading is awesome, but as a busy parent and I've got all these things, a lot of them have your audio where you're reading it. And that has been cool. Like when you're unloading the dishwasher, like you can become educated about all these topics that we've done a quick breeze over today and so many more topics in far more depth. So that I've really, really been enjoying that. So thank you for the resources that you put out into the world and for being you. And all right, friends, well, take good care of yourselves. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.